From SBR News, this is Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. During Thanksgiving, we remember the pilgrims who came to the New World to find a better life. On today's version of Inland Journal, we'll talk with a pilgrim of a different kind. Former Spokane peace activist Jim Thomas has written Atomic Pilgrim. It's the story of his 6,700-mile walk to raise awareness about the dangers of nuclear war. This was in the early 1980s, when the Cold War was still raging and there were worries about a possible World War III. Eliza Billingham talks with Spokane nurse Hannah Vankara, who's on a mission to convince the military to allow amputees like her to serve in the armed forces. And Faves News reporter Lake Lust has written about international university students in the Spokane area who are navigating a new culture and leaning on each other. We'll talk with Lake today on Inland Journal. Former Spokane peace activist Jim Thomas made a name for himself as a researcher who investigated the history of the Hanford nuclear site. Hanford's role was to create plutonium for the atomic bomb dropped over Nagasaki, Japan in August 1945. Before that, Thomas had one of the most defining experiences of his life. He and 19 others walked 6,700 miles to raise awareness about the dangers of nuclear war.
We walked across the United States in 1982, starting from Seattle to D.C., and then in 1983, we walked across Europe to Bethlehem, arriving there on Christmas Eve of 1983.
This was a time when the Cold War was still raging, and there were worries about a possible World War III. Why did you go on this long pilgrimage?
There were many reasons. 1982 was one of the darkest years of the Cold War. It was the year before ABC televised The Day After, which really galvanized people's fears of nuclear war.
The Day After was essentially the day after a nuclear explosion.
Yes. And I didn't see it because by that time we were walking across Greece, I think, nearing Bethlehem. There was President Reagan and his huge nuclear weapons buildup as part of the largest peacetime expansion of U.S. military. But nuclear was a big part of that, going toe-to-toe with the Soviets. And the rhetoric was, and the actions, were becoming a great concern to people all across the United States. I mean, I knew couples who were really seriously grappling with whether or not they should have children because they didn't want their kids to grow up in a nuclear devastated landscape. So it was a concern, but also I was with people who were doing something about that, organizing this peace walk. Our eldest pilgrim was a retired Catholic priest from Michigan. His name was Father George Zabelka. And during World War II, he had been the Catholic chaplain to the men who dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, you know, the pilgrimage provided an opportunity for me to get to know George, but also the other pilgrims were, you know, deeply spiritual, deeply concerned, and wanted to do something. And I think that's the other thing that ties the pilgrimage in with my Hanford work, is that these were very large, seemingly intractable, you know, nuclear issues, very technical, but also wrapped up in national security. And how dare citizens question that? And so both with the pilgrimage and our tight-knit group of 20 pilgrims, but also with the staff and the volunteers connected to the Hanford Education Action League, we were taking up our role as citizens and doing something about things that gave us quite concern, and we wanted to change those policies.
What do you feel like you accomplished with that pilgrimage?
Well, in general, in the towns that we went through, we gave people hope. They were just so thankful that somebody was doing something about this huge threat of nuclear war. But at the same time, for me, the pilgrimage left me with a deep sense of the wonder of creation. you know, we spent 8-10 hours a day walking outside in all kinds of weather and getting in touch with the rhythm of the seasons. It was wonderful. But probably the thing that has surprised me the most and stuck with me the longest and the deepest is by meeting so many people in red states, in blue states. Most of the time when you're walking between cities, you're walking out in rural areas and through small towns. You know, we walked through 9 other countries, and people were so generous and welcoming of us. And it was kind of hard some days because, you know, we were trudging. Oftentimes we didn't smell the best. Sometimes we'd go maybe a whole week without a shower. Same with laundry. But yet people opened their homes to us, gave us food, dialogued with us. And it convinced me of our common humanity and the beauty of each individual person wherever they live on the globe.
We're talking with former Spokane resident Jim Thomas, author of the book Atomic Pilgrim. After that experience, Thomas returned to the States and began looking for what would be next in his life.
I started working for the Diocese of Spokane, coordinating peace and justice, but that was only a half-time position. And the other half of the time, I started researching what I could with HEAL about Hanford. In 1984, there was very little public information available. But both with journalists such as Karen Dorn Steele, Bob Alvarez, and other environmentalists teaching us how to file a Freedom of Information Act request, as well as people with Native American tribes in the Northwest, and both the Washington State and State of Oregon, all clamoring for documents. What was the history of operating Hanford? About the only thing we knew was that Hanford had produced the plutonium that was used in the bomb that destroyed Nagasaki.
So you talked about 6 years with HEAL. If you look back at those 6 years, what would you point at as the greatest accomplishments? What did you get done during those 6 years?
The main thing is that we successfully asserted our rights as citizens to have a meaningful role in the decisions being made about Hanford. There was the DOS Reconstruction study about the historical releases. There were studies about the suitability of the Hanford site being the nation's high-level waste repository. And the thing that fascinated me the most, and I kind of focused on this, was digging into the history of Hanford and understanding not just what happened, but how and why.
And then Karen, I think, as you write, broke the story about the green run. In other words, the iodine put into the air, and then that led to the growth of the downwinders and the development of that. That's been pretty important just in helping people understand what are the medical consequences of radiation.
Yes, especially with regard to the kinds of radiation that Hanford released. So you mentioned the Green Run, which was the largest single release of iodine-131, radioactive iodine, into the air from Hanford, about 11,000 curies. That was in December of 1949, an intentional release. The other releases far overshadowed the amount of that, because in 1945 alone, more than 500,000 curies were released of iodine-131, and it was from routine operations. The plant was working as designed. They didn't have any filters for the first 3 years. And interestingly, what the Hanford Environmental Dose Reconstruction Project found, scientists at Battelle, more than half of those 500,000 curies were released after Japan surrendered, after there was a war emergency. And I still don't have the answers to that, the satisfying answers of why they increased production after Japan surrendered.
Let's circle back to the end of Jim Thomas's Atomic Pilgrimage in 1983. Much happened over the next several years to lower the threat of a nuclear holocaust.
Thankfully, both President Reagan and the Soviet leader by that time, Gorbachev, had saner minds and the courage to start disarming. That picked up a lot of speed in 1991 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And within a few years, we went from 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world to under 15,000. And currently, there's about 12,500 nuclear weapons in the world. So much reduced. Humanity had a collective sigh of relief. Unfortunately, Putin invaded Ukraine the first time and annexed Crimea starting in 2014. And even under the Obama administration, we started to initiate a modernization, a so-called modernization, or basically updating and expanding our nuclear arsenal. Subsequent to that, Putin has continued to increase his nuclear arsenals and capabilities, developing new delivery mechanisms. And unfortunately, China, which had for, 50 years, been content with a minimum deterrence, only about 300 nuclear weapons, basically the same amount as both France and the UK have. But it started building new silos, putting new nuclear weapons into those. Now the CIA estimates that China has between 600 and 700 nuclear warheads, so doubling its amount, and that by the end of this decade, so in 5 years, they'll have 1,000 is the projection. So nuclear weapons are very much on the back on the front burner, and they need to be in people's consciousness.
That's researcher Jim Thomas, the author of Atomic Pilgrim, which was published this year by Latah Books. Today, SBR's Eliza Billingham is a guest in studio. She's a Spokane emergency room nurse with a career goal that she hasn't yet been able to fulfill.
Could we start by you introducing yourself and talking about your desire to be in the military and why that's complicated?
Yeah, so my name is Hannah Van Kara. I'm a nurse here in Spokane. I've been wanting to serve in the military as a flight nurse for 4 years now. And I started that process back in 2021, but it's been complicated to try to join because I'm missing a leg below the knee. It's from a congenital birth defect called fibular hemimelia. So I had a lot of surgeries as a kid. And even though I pass all the fitness tests required to join and am extremely active, the military had a disqualification for civilian amputees trying to join.
You may have read in the New York Times about Van Kara's fight to serve. Eliza wrote about her in The Inlander. Up until now, Van Kara has been thwarted in her attempts to become a military flight nurse. But there's a new chapter to the story, complete with an unexpected plot twist. Van Kara came into the studio to pick up where the previous cliffhanger left off. Once the military told her no, she decided there had to be a way to convince the right people that she's capable of doing the job.
I went to my congresswoman after being denied accession into service, and we started a bill in Congress together to try to change those standards for amputees trying to join if they can pass all the fitness tests required.
Can you talk a little bit about the fitness tests and the waiver process for people who aren't familiar?
When you try to join, whether it's officer or enlisted, and in my case, it would have been as an officer, as a nurse, you have to go through the MEPS process. And you have to complete this physical with one of the military doctors, and they review all your medical history. And it's not like the good old days where you can just show up with your packet of paper describing all your medical conditions. They look through everything. It's all electronic medical records now. So they will collect all of your surgeries, past medical history, and they'll review that, and they'll generate waivers based off of the things that aren't currently accepted in the military. What I found out with having an amputation, though, is that that was absolutely disqualifying. There wasn't even a waiver available to progress and actually commission as an officer. So back in 2021, when I was facing this barrier trying to join, I went to my congresswoman, I talked about the issue, and that's when we decided to move forward with a bill. It was called the Hannah Van Kara Service Act, and it basically stated and proposed that anyone with an amputation should be allowed to serve as long as they pass all standard military fitness requirements without accommodation. And that bill went to National Congress, and I went over the past 3 years, I went to DC twice to lobby for this bill. It passed the House twice as part of the National Defense Authorization Act and went to the Senate. The Senate ultimately deferred it to the DOD, or Department of War, excuse me, for their decision. Going to the House and Senate, I talked to both senators and reps and discussed, here's the challenges we're facing with military recruitment in general. Here's me in person trying to join. And yes, I am missing a leg, but I want them to know that what they see on paper is not reality. I'm very proud that I think I got very far with that, because in the 3 to 4 years of advocating for this bill, so many people, I would say hundreds of people, came out from under the rocks all over the country saying, hey, I have this issue too, XYZ. It may not have been an amputation, but they were denied for another reason. They never felt like they had the chance to serve. So what happened ultimately was, earlier this year, I'm happy to announce that Congress issued the first explicit recognition that amputees do get a fair pathway and a chance into military service. And Congress is now officially encouraging the Department of War to expand waiver consideration for amputees. And that wasn't an option before. It just needed addressing. Amputees now get a chance to serve, which wasn't possible under the old accession rules. I take joy in fighting for others, especially those who are misrepresented. As I mentioned earlier, I am a nurse and I care for others who can't care for themselves. And I love fighting for people who are able to do things and to make sure they know that they're not broken. People who just need a fair shot. And so seeing this change happen is proof that persistence matters, and now Congress and the Department of War know that this problem exists, and they're trying to do something to change that.
Because you weren't trying to lower standards, right? You were just trying to draw attention to a group of people that meet the standards?
Correct. Yeah. I want to be clear. I'm not asking the military to lower standards just for the sake of inclusivity. In fact, I believe the opposite. A strong military needs strong standards, and I'm proud of the improvements we've seen over the past year. But the problem was never the standards itself. It was an outdated rule in the military medical standards for service that excluded civilian amputees without considering what modern prosthetic technology can actually do. Today's prosthetics are remarkable. In many cases, people using them are stronger physically and even emotionally because they've lived their whole lives adapting and pushing through that adversity. So I don't think the military was factoring in that consideration before with modern prosthetic technology. They were allowing people to stay in who lost limbs while in service, but they didn't want to take on the liability of letting people join who were already amputees.
So what does this rule change mean for you?
I started this journey to try to get in myself, and it's morphed and changed into this journey that has supported so many other people. And I never expected the amount of support, the people that I was able to help, and I couldn't ask for a better outcome. It's young people and future soldiers coming up behind us, behind everyone here right now, who want to serve but face medical barriers. So now they have a path forward that didn't exist before. So to me, that's pretty life-changing. However, now that this change has been made and the opportunity exists, I am choosing not to pursue joining the military as a nurse right now. I'm getting married next year to an active duty service member. His name is Ben, and supporting Ben's journey as a pilot is now my priority for our family. This wasn't about me getting a slot in the military. It was about creating a pathway for every capable amputee and every capable person in general who dreams of serving. And those who want to serve should be able to do so. And that's enough for me. I'll continue serving as an ER nurse and eventually flight nursing in the civilian world. But I'm kind of dropping the mic on this for myself. And I'm hoping that someone else takes up the reins and continues moving forward.
That's Spokane Emergency Room nurse Hannah Van Kara talking with SBR's Eliza Billingham. Our colleagues at Faves News have begun a six-part series called Building Bridges. The guiding principle is that including people and groups of all faiths and backgrounds is essential to building strong communities. The series is funded by Humanities Washington. The first installment is about international students in the Inland Northwest who are navigating their new homes in turbulent times. The writer is Lake Lust.
Moving from anywhere abroad into the United States is already such a shift. But moving to Eastern Washington specifically comes with its own cultural attributes, right? Like, this is a very, like, Christian-heavy area. There's a really high degree of religious participation in Eastern Washington. And if you were raised abroad in, like, a traditional Hindu environment, traditional Muslim environment, and you're expecting to come to, like, a very multicultural place like America, you might have a different impression. So that was kind of my thoughts when I was first starting the story and designing questions and figuring out who to reach out to. When I set out to report, I was basically looking at any international student leaders on campuses in the area to see, like, what their experience with religious participation is. Like, how are you interacting with American Christianity? How has this shaped, like, your traditional beliefs? How has your religious participation changed and why? And basically, what is your campus experience like in regards to faith?
And once you approached them, were they eager to talk?
Yeah, I think because the people I were talking to, they were, you know, they are leaders in their community anyways. Like, obviously, they're already very passionate and very used to discussing these types of issues. So I had very, very long, very interesting conversations with everyone, which, you know, is my favorite thing to do as a journalist. It's to speak with someone who's just completely stoked about my story. That makes it easier to have a long conversation. And yeah, you know, these folks have had such interesting religious journeys. You know, I talked to one source who was raised in a traditional Hindu environment and then became skeptical about his faith, identified as an atheist for a while, became skeptical about that, and then converted to Christianity. And so just kind of hearing how, you know, living in the United States, going to university influenced that journey was really interesting. So yeah, very, very interesting people.
As I recall, you went to Whitworth and you went to Eastern, a secular school and a Christian school. Did you find differences, similarities between the folks who were going to those two schools?
Yeah. All the international students I spoke with had kind of a similar things to say regarding the difference between international student culture and domestic student culture, namely that the experience of international students is pretty similar because they tend to stick together. They have separate orientations for international versus domestic students. They have, you know, international advisors that they go to. They have sometimes the same dorm building, the same club spaces. And so they do a lot of bonding within the international student group. And sometimes, you know, there are incidents, or maybe it's less accessible to like fully integrate, if you will, with the domestic students on campus.
So did they find themselves uncomfortable here in some cases, or do they feel like they get along okay?
Kind of both. I mean, there are always incidents. There was an incident that one source mentioned that I discussed in my article where they just had to witness a preacher on the EWU campus saying some pretty Islamophobic rhetoric. And, you know, this is from someone who has like a lot of Muslim friends through their international community. And so hearing that can kind of be disturbing. You hear a lot of like microaggressions, right, from people who are not necessarily being racist or anything, but just, you know, have never meaningfully interacted with people from other countries because they've been born and raised in this area. And so they just say things that are maybe a little ignorant, but not mean-spirited per se. So, but, you know, but another theme that everyone told me is that that's just kind of all part of the exchange student experience in particular, where you come here to learn about another culture. And even when it's uncomfortable, you are definitely still learning how to witness stuff like that, learning how to react to it, learning how to assert yourself. And so that, I thought that was pretty cool.
So these people then are conduits to folks from their past lives, their past cultures. Do they talk any about whether they would recommend folks come to the United States to experience this, or are they trying to warn people away from it?
You know, I didn't specifically ask whether they would recommend the experience to others, but everyone I spoke with definitely did not regret coming here. Obviously, there's, you know, it's a little tenuous right now, the status of immigrants and visas in this country. It can be a little scary or just, you know, uncertain. So maybe now is like not a great time. Like, we're seeing international student enrollment dropping. So I'm sure that's a factor in a lot of people's minds. But as far as the folks who have been here, who already did it, who went through 4 years of college in the United States, I definitely said that they gained a lot from it.
So we as reporters, when we do a story, we learn ourselves about certain things. What did you learn from this story?
I learned that people are so much more open to change than I previously realized. And people are more open to being multi-faith than I previously realized. Like, I talked to a lot of folks who don't necessarily identify with one religion or another, but who will go to mosques and church and synagogue just because they enjoy the experience of interacting with many cultures. And I thought that was inspirational and just a really great way to learn about the world. And maybe that's like a practice I would feel inspired to do myself, to, you know, visit different faith institutions and just see what I can learn from other people's cultures too.
Lake Lust is a freelance reporter for Faves News. You can read Lake's story about international students in the Inland Northwest at Faves, that's F-A-V-S, .news. Or we've linked to it in the online post for this program at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Inland Journal is the weekly public affairs program produced at SBR News. It airs on the radio Thursdays at 12:30 and Saturdays at 2:30, and it's available online anytime at SpokanePublicRadio.org. We thank you for listening. I'm Doug Nadvornik.